really 1 to 15, 1 to 16, more than first half. And then verses 17, 18, 19 we'll look at next week. It's encouraging to sing songs like the last one we just sang, Great is Thy Faithfulness. Sometimes we don't feel that. Sometimes we mouth the words, though we want to mean the words. But sometimes it's necessary to say the words, even though our hearts don't align yet. And that's what happens with Habakkuk. He has moved from the questioning prophet to the worshiping prophet. And something just extraordinary has happened in his life. He's encountered the living God. And in our text this morning, he's going to respond to what he has seen and heard in God. And it's a hymn. All of this that we're looking at this morning is a hymn. There's a couple of hints at that. The phrase, according to Shigionoth, that is not a name. That is actually a style of music, a type of music. And so he's saying, write this down, sing this song according to this style, this song, this tune. And then there's a couple of other phrases. Selah is repeated three times in the text. Selah is a musical term. It means to pause and rest and think on what you've just sang. And we did that just now when Willie and the music really paused and the music sort of kept going. It's intended to be a rest. Beethoven says the best musicians play not only the notes but also the rests. The rest is also just as important, pausing and thinking and meditating on. And so that's what we're going to do this morning as we look at this text. We're going to see three things. First, Habakkuk's prayer, and his prayer is a response to all that he's seen, all that he's heard, particularly verse 20 in chapter 2, that God is on the throne, therefore I don't have to be, and that's all I need. That's all I need to know. And that leads him to worship in verse 3 down to verse 15, he worships, he responds, he articulates what he has seen and heard about God. And then in verse 16, he turns the corner, he just says, I will wait, I will rest. He pauses, he trusts, and then he comes to the famous statements in 17, 18, and 19 that I will trust no matter what. So we're going to see this morning those three things. Before we get there, we need to understand the context. When you watch TV shows, they normally start with previously on. And it's a recap so that you can remember what has been covered. And when we binge watch whole seasons, we often think, well, I don't need that. I've already watched the previous seven episodes. Now I'm on the eighth, so I don't need the previously on. So you skip it. But we need this for a couple of reasons. One, because we come and go and we are here and not here and we haven't heard and we don't connect the dots. But two, because his worship, his response, is brightened, illuminated, heightened by understanding the context of where he's come from. We'll do this. Let's first look at how he uses this phrase, look and see, through the storyline of Habakkuk. When it begins in chapter 1, verse 3, he says, how can you make me see iniquity? And why do you look idly on sin? Why do you tolerate it? Why do you not do anything? See and look, Habakkuk says. Where are you, God? This is the question. Are you there? Do you know what's going on? Do you know what I'm dealing with? Do you know me? Do you even see me? The bigger question that Habakkuk's opening with in those first four verses is, God, can I trust you? Can I trust you with my circumstances, with what I see right now, right before me, with what I'm feeling? Are you there? Can I trust you? And amazingly, in verse 5, so quickly in the text, God answers. God responds, and he uses Habakkuk's own words. In verse 5, he says, look and see. He reverses them. Habakkuk says, see and look. Now God says, look and see, I am doing a work. In other words, when we hear look and see, that's a statement of I hear you, Habakkuk. I see you, Habakkuk. I know you, Habakkuk. I know your needs. I know your circumstances. I know the chaos. I know the pain. I know the heartache. I know the worry. I know the anxiety. I know you. And I'm doing something. And I am working. Look and see, I'm doing a work. I'm not only intimately near, I'm also powerful and able. I'm not only powerful and able, but I'm also intimately near. It's a profound response that we get. Now, it's not the response Habakkuk wants, because what does God say in his response? I do see you, I do I am looking on your circumstances, the evil that's in your midst, and I am doing a work, and I'm going to address the evil that's in your midst by raising up another evil people to come in your midst. And Habakkuk immediately responds in verse 13, wait, what? And he uses the same phrase, look and see. How can you, who are of eyes purer than to look on sin, how can you look on evil? How can you do this? I don't understand. I want to understand. More than that, I want to trust you, but I don't understand. And that leads to what Habakkuk says in chapter 2, verse 1. In chapter 2, verse 1, he says, I will wait and look and see how God will respond to me, how God will correct me. I don't have all the puzzle pieces. I don't see everything from his perspective. I certainly don't feel in this moment like he's in charge and he's working. But I believe that he is. I want to believe that he is. And so I will wait and I will see how he will respond to me and how he will correct me. And then in chapter 2, verse 2 down to 20, God answers again. And he answers initially by saying to Habakkuk, write down the vision. Write down, vision means revelation. Write down what I reveal to you. In other words, write down what I show you. Write down what you see in my answer. And what's the answer that he gives? In chapter 2, verse 4, the puffed up, arrogant one who trusts in his own strength, chapter 1, verse 11, chapter 2, verse 2a, the one who hopes in himself will be destroyed. But the one who hopes in me, the one who trusts me, trusts that I know, trusts that I'm working, trusts that I'm on the throne, trust me, he will live. Trust in my faithfulness and you will live. Trust in my work on your behalf and you will live. Despair of your own work, your own self, trust in my work and you will live. Despair of my work, hope in yourself, you will die. It will end in destruction. And that's what he does in chapter 2, verse 2, all the way down to 20, is he describes the end, the woes of the one who hopes in himself, the puffed up one. He will be destroyed. And it ends in verse 20 in this amazing statement that God gives. In chapter 2, verse 20 says, but the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. What's he saying there? He's answering Habakkuk's greatest worry, greatest fear. Is God, are you there? God, do you know? God, are you even working? God, are you even present? And what does God say? Absolutely. I am on the throne and I am working. Look and see. Be silent. And Habakkuk responds in chapter 3 to what he has seen, to that answer. In chapter 3, he begins to respond. It's his response, it's his reaction, and it's fittingly put to song. It's not just, this is what's amazing about this text, to chapter 3, it's his personal insight, remembrance of all of God's past faithfulness, but it's put to song because it's meant to be sung by the people of God over and over again. In other words, Habakkuk and all the people of God are to plant a flag in this confession that God is faithful and he's on the throne, has all power and knows what he's doing, and that's all I need. That's what Habakkuk is going to sing. It's the song of his heart. It's not just a statement. It's not just an intellectual insight. It's his emotions welling up out of his mouth into action. This is who God is, and I will rest in that. That's my hope. That's all that I need. That's what Habakkuk is doing here. And essentially in chapter 3, what's he saying? In chapter 3, verse 2, he says, oh Lord, I have heard. That's another way of saying, I've heard all that you've said. I've seen all that you said. Now I see. It's the same response that Job gave in chapter 42, verse 5. After God confronts Job's accusers and includes Job in the conversation in chapter 38 and says, were you there when I made the earth and the mountains and the sea? Can you track to the beginning of the lightning bolt? Do you know? Can you store up the snow? Can you wag little Leviathan by the tail? Oh, cute little Leviathan. Can you do that? Do you know how to count all the stars and know each of their names? And he humbles them. And in chapter 42, verse 5, Job says, I have heard, but now I see. Now I understand. I see that you are a God that is infinite and powerful and yet intimate and near to your people. You are faithful and powerful and on your throne, and you are for us. Particularly Job saying, you're for me. And that's all I need. Habakkuk is a little Job. The book of Habakkuk is just simply Job in microcosm. And that's where we land. God, I see that you're on the throne. And I don't have to be. That's what I desperately needed more than anything else. I will trust you. And that response, that leads to a response. And the initial response is prayer. Prayer. It's not first a request, it's a confession. It's a humble confession, and it's a remembrance of who God is, and then there's a request in what he confesses. Look at what he says here in verse 2. He says, O Lord, I have heard the report of you and your work, O Lord. Do I fear? Fear means awe, stand in awe of, revere, stand in wonder of. In the midst of the years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. The first thing he says is, I have heard. Heard what? I have heard of all your past faithfulness. I have heard of all your past faithfulness to the people of God. I've heard beyond just your rescue out of Egypt. I've heard how you created the universe, how you spoke and it all came into being, how you established mankind out of the dust of the earth. I've heard how you were faithful after man rebelled. I heard how you established us out of nothing, out of one man, Abraham, in the land of the Babylonians, how you created us out of nothing, how we were only 70 people when we entered Egypt. And then when we left, we were millions of people. How Pharaoh, the serpent king, tried to destroy and crush us. And yet you came to our aid in swift power and rescued us out of Egypt. I have heard how you at the Red Sea, when death was before them and death was behind them, parted the waters and led them through on dry ground. I have heard how you came and appeared to them on Sinai in thundering power and revealed yourself. And they heard you audibly and they saw the mountain quaking and they felt the earth trembling beneath their feet. I have heard how you provided every step of the way into the promised land and through those 40 years before the promised land. I have heard of your great power and great faithfulness. And what is the request that Habakkuk makes? I know that's who you were. And I know that's who you are. And he says twice in the text, in the midst of our present circumstances, revive who you were and who you are. Come be that now for us. We desperately need you, the faithful God, the powerful God, the one who you were and the one who you are. We desperately need that now. Come invade our circumstances. Be present here and now. He says in the text, in the midst of the years, in the midst of he says it twice, in the right now, right here of our pain and the suffering, revive it. Revive your past character, your past nature. It's not just in the past, it's who you are. Come be that now. What's fascinating, and he's asking, he's remembering the character and the nature of God, and he says, revive that character and nature here and now. What's fascinating about what he's doing is he doesn't just ask God to remove him and the people of Judah from their circumstances. And he doesn't ask him to remove their circumstances from them. He says, God, more than I need to be out of my circumstances, I need you in my circumstances. I don't care what circumstances I'm in. If I don't have you, I'm doomed. I'm crushed. What is he confessing? God, you are all I need. Your wisdom, your power, your strength, your faithfulness, your love, your grace, your greatness. I just need that. That's what I need here and now, no matter the circumstances. That's what he's asking for. It reminds me of Elizabeth Elliot's famous quote. Elizabeth Elliot was married to Jim Elliot. They were both missionaries. And Jim Elliot was killed instantly upon meeting, first at contact with those that he was trying to share the gospel with. And she now is without a husband. And she, through those circumstances and others, said, "The secret is Christ in me, not me in a different set of circumstances." I don't need out of the circumstances, and I don't need the circumstances removed. I need you here and now in the midst of whatever circumstances I find myself in. And that's what Habakkuk is doing. And because he knows God is on the throne, because he's begging God to come be here now in the midst, Habakkuk says, "I can rest. Because you're on the throne, I don't have to be. Because that's all I needed to know. I know that's all I need. I need you, and I need you on the throne. I don't need to be, because when I'm on the throne, everything is destroyed. I just need you." And that's the secret that's being revealed here in this text to us. It's the secret that Paul recognizes in Philippians chapter 4. Whether in feast or in famine, whether in feast or in the fire, regardless of the circumstances, what I desperately need is Christ in me. That's the hope. That's the strength. Habakkuk is making a similar confession. All I need is God and God alone. If I have him, then that's all that matters. I can walk through any circumstances. And that's the mechanism that turned Habakkuk from the prophet in anguish to the prophet in awe, as it says in verse 2. He's in fear, means to be in awe. From the questioning prophet to the trusting prophet. See, we think that in the midst of our pain, in the midst of our trials, in the midst of our terrible circumstances, suffering, whatever they may be, we think that when we can't see everything, that we've got to launch into and try to grip and grab and control and write the script for God. Because he needs our help. And Habakkuk is saying, he doesn't need my help. We think that in the midst of our circumstances, when we feel like it's the doldrums and there's just no sign of God's presence and that he's not there, we think that we need to go from him to other sources of rescue and hope. And what the text, what all of this is going to teach us is we know what the answer is not. Habakkuk has showed us the answer is not running from God with our questions. It's running to God with our questions. It's not running from his word looking for other sources of wisdom. It's running to his word with our doubts and fears and worries and anxieties and questions. It's not to abandon him. It's to cling to him. And that's exactly what Habakkuk does from chapter 1, verse 1, all the way through. And in chapter 1, verse 1, we saw it. He does not feel like it. He's asking questions without the feelings. But by the end, because he has clung to God and God has been faithful through it all, the feelings come. And it erupts in worship. It starts as a whisper and it turns into a song from his heart. Have you ever been in this kind of situation? Have you ever found yourself in this? Where we're lamenting and anguishing and we feel like God's silent and we wonder, as Habakkuk did, are you even there? Can I trust you? Well, what Habakkuk shows us by the pattern of this book is that he doesn't run from God to find answers. He runs to God. He brings his questions about God to God. And we must do the same thing. He is staking his flag in the ground that God is faithful. And that's all I need to know. And we have to do the same thing. God, I don't know if you love me. Do you even know what I'm going through? That's what we ask sometimes. In that first question, God, I don't know if you love me. We have to say, no, I feel like he doesn't love me, but I will look at the cross and the greatest testimony of his love. I will look in the face of Jesus. I will recall the gospel. I will not forsake the gospel. I will cling to the gospel. The gospel teaches me that God so infinitely, lavishly loves me that he sacrificed his own son for me. The other part of the question is, God, I don't know if you know what I'm going through. No, I will look at the cross. He entered into suffering and suffered for me. He knows exactly what it's like to feel forsaken. He knows exactly what it's like to feel forgotten. He knows exactly what it's like to feel brutalized, to feel abused, to be accused. He knows what it's like to suffer. So I will cling to that and stake my flag in the ground that he is a faithful God. And this is what leads Habakkuk here to worship. It leads him to worship. So we hear in verse 2, O Lord, I have heard. But we don't get a lot of the details of what he heard. What is it that he saw? What is it that he heard? What is it that he's remembering and recounting and that should turn into, it turns into song for him and should be our song as well? What is it that he's recounting? In verse 3, we begin to get a glimpse into it. 3 down to 15 is what he has seen and heard, what he is remembering and rehearsing. And it begins in verse 3. He says, God came from Timon and the Holy One from Mount Paran. The first thing that Habakkuk remembers and rehearses and recalls to mind is that God is faithful, no matter what. He always has been, he always is, and he always will be. How on earth do you get that from Timon and Paran? Timon and Paran were cities or places geographically in the south, particularly in the southern Sinai Peninsula. They're where Israel has come from. More importantly, more specifically, they are places that God has led his people out of. Timon and Paran. Paran was the place, the mountain. Mount Paran was the mountain that he took his people to look into the promised land, where they refused to trust him. And then they walked in the wilderness for 40 years. And yet, what did he do through all those 40 years? He provided them all the way down to the soles of their feet. And then what did he do? He brought them back to that, and he led them into the promised land, into lands that were not their own, to conquer people that were more powerful and larger and stronger than they were. He provided for them. He was faithful to them. The other thing that's in the southern Sinai Peninsula is Sinai, where God made himself known visually and audibly on the mountain, Mount Sinai, where he gave the commandments. And right before the commandments in chapter 20 of Exodus is chapter 19, where he reminds them of all that he did to get them out of Egypt. His power, his might, his strength in rescuing them out of the grips of the serpent king Pharaoh. And then his revelation of his power on Mount Sinai. What's fascinating is when he says Timon and Paran, he's recalling God's past faithfulness. But why doesn't he just say Mount Sinai? Why doesn't he just say Egypt? By calling it Timon and Paran, he is pointing in a general direction backwards. He's saying God has been faithful specific times in your past, and he has always been faithful as long as you can look in that direction. In other words, here's the question that Habakkuk is being asked or is asking and answering. Has there ever been a time when God has not been faithful? Don't just let that roll over your head and out one ear. Lodge that in your heart and ask that question. Has there ever, ever, ever been a time when he has not been faithful? That's what Habakkuk is remembering in this moment. He's pointing back to Sinai, back to the promised land, Mount Paran, back to before that, which was Sinai, back to before that, which is the Red Sea, back to before that, which is the Egypt and the plagues in Egypt, back to even before that, to Abraham out of nothing, back to even before that, all the way to Genesis, back to all the way before that, when God created the heavens and the earth and created man from dust of the earth. He is recalling God's infinite past faithfulness. That's what he has seen. That's what he has heard. And that's what he's asking for God to come and do here and now. What's also interesting is by referencing Timon and Mount Paran, or referencing from the south geographically, every time that's mentioned, Deuteronomy chapter 33, Judges chapter 5, Psalm chapter 68, every time it's mentioned that God led his people out of the south, he led them as a warrior fighting on their behalf. He led them with transcendent power. And that's the second thing that Habakkuk is remembering in this moment. Not only has he always been faithful, he has always leveraged his power on behalf of his people. In grace, he's always come to them to rescue them, to pour out his power on his enemies, on our enemies, to rescue us and set us free. Habakkuk 3, the second half, down to verse 6, he says, his splendor covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise. His brightness was like the light. Rays flashed from his hand, and there he veiled his power. Before him, pestilence and plague followed at his heels. In other words, pestilence and plague saluted him. The locust bowed before him and went forth marching as his vessel tool to rescue and redeem his people. He rules over the earth. He stood and he measured the earth. He looked and he shook the nations. Then the eternal mountains were scattered. The everlasting hills sank low. His were everlasting ways. What on earth is Habakkuk remembering? He's saying that his splendor, the splendor and brightness of God's glory, shines forth. It's so blinding. It's so miraculous, amazing, but it's also so blinding that we can only barely get glimpses of how powerful he is. As he said to Job, what you know of me is but the fringes of my ways. Which I've said, another way of understanding the fringes is that's the little plastic thing on the end of your shoelace. That's how much we understand of God. That's how much we understand of his infinite, transcendent power. To say it's transcendent means it supersedes, it precedes, it's superior to all power. He has universe-making power, and it's recalled in this text. He shakes the nations, the language, it's figurative, like shaking out a rug. He can clean the earth like a rug, shaking it out, removing the dust from it. It says he measures the earth. Isaiah chapter 44 says he measures the universe by the breadth of his hand. It says that the eternal mountains were scattered. The everlasting hills sank low. In other words, the one thing visually for us that we think will never be destroyed, these great mountains, if you've ever been to the Rockies or the Swiss Alps, you see these mountains, they just shoot up before you, 13, 14,000 feet. They go straight up in what looks like just complete impenetrable rock that cannot move. It crumbles before God's power. It shakes in terror before his power. It trembles before him. The everlasting, permanent hills that will never be moved are nothing before his authority, before his power. His power is limitless. It's immovable, far greater than immovable mountains. And now we get to verse 7. How does God's infinite transcendent power compare to his enemies or to ours? How does God's infinite transcendent power compare to this world superpower that is on the rise and on the move and marching towards Judah right now? Verse 7, I saw the tents of Kushan in affliction. The curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. What is he saying here? He's already recounted God has universe-making power, transcendent. He shakes the nations like a rug. He measures the earth. Isaiah 44 says he measures all the nations of the earth like a little $5 bucket from a Home Depot. He fills all the nations of the earth with the bucket and just walks around with it. This God who has transcendent, infinite, superior power, how does it compare to his enemies? While the mountains quake and tremble at his power, his enemies, while he has superior crushing power even over the everlasting hills, his enemies hide in tents. They hide behind curtains. Do you see the imagery? What on earth can a curtain do to protect you from a God who can speak and universes come into existence? What on earth can a curtain do to protect our enemies from a God who shakes out the nations like a rug? They quiver, they quake behind fabric when He is the infinite transcendent God. This last week, with all those storms that just came through, my wife and I, right before some of those were coming through and a break in one of the storms, we got a text from some people, friends of ours that live in West Mobile, and they said, hey, the wind is really serious. It really is coming through 40, 60 miles an hour, and there's hail, just letting you know. And so we have this sunshade sail on our back porch. You've seen these canopies that just provides shade, and it's fabric. And so we said, let's go take that down. We need to probably take that down in the storm. So the storm's coming. We can kind of hear it grumbling off in the distance. I go up. I get a ladder. I take one side down. I have it. The wind gusts. It yanks it. And my wife is there. She helps. We reel it in. And now I've got the ladder moved. I'm putting one foot up on the ladder. And I'm about to reach up and grab the metal turnbuckle to undo it. And at that moment, I saw the flash and instantly heard, boom! It was that quick. And I'm not afraid to confess to you that in that moment, I took the curtain that was in my hands and covered my head just like this. What is that curtain going to do to protect me from the lightning bolt that has already hit? I didn't even have time to blink. The flash and the boom were instantaneous. And I covered myself with a curtain. And my wife jumped on top of me in that moment. I asked her, like, what were you doing? I was trying to make sure you hadn't been struck by lightning. No, you weren't. You were trying to get under the curtain with me. Both of us in that moment, instantaneously. And what does a curtain do to protect us from a lightning bolt? That's the comparison and contrast that Habakkuk has seen and is hearing and is remembering and is rehearsing. Now think about the context. Why is that so important at this moment in time in history for them? Because on the horizon is a world superpower, Babylon, that's approaching and going to take them into exile. And what Habakkuk is remembering is that if God can rescue His people out of slavery in Egypt and lead them in an exodus out of the tyrannical rule of the serpent king Pharaoh, then He can do it again in Babylon. If He can do that, then He can do this. If He is faithful and powerful to do that, then He can do that again if He so chooses. Habakkuk is remembering God's past faithfulness, and he's bringing it into his current circumstances. He's preaching it to himself. And it's supposed to be a song. It's supposed to be a song that people will sing forever. That they will not forget. That if God can lead an exodus of His people out of slavery, He can lead them into and out of an exodus in slavery in Babylon, and He will be with them and for them. And that's the third thing he's remembering here. In verse 8 down to 10, he's remembering that God has this transcendent power, and what does He use what does He do with that transcendent power? He uses it to rescue His people, to provide for them and to protect them. Was your wrath against the rivers, verse 8? O Lord, was your anger against the rivers, or your indignation against the sea? When you rode on your horses, on your chariot of salvation, you stripped the sheath from your bow, calling for many arrows. Selah. Meditate on that. You split the earth with rivers. The mountains you saw and writhed, and the raging waters swept on. The deep gave forth its voice. It lifted its hands on high. The sun and the moon stood still. There's a promised land rescue story he's recounting there. In their place, at the light of your arrows as they sped, at the flash of your glittering spear, you marched through the earth in fury. You threshed the nations in anger. You went out for the salvation of your people, the salvation of your anointed. You crushed the head of the house of the wicked, laying him bare from thigh to neck. Selah. Meditate on this. You pierced with His own arrows the heads of His warriors, who came like a whirlwind to scatter me, rejoicing as if to devour the poor in secret. You trampled the sea with your horses, the surging of mighty waters. If it hasn't been clear, Habakkuk is clearly remembering the past faithfulness of God, the past power of God in the life of Israel, but he's remembering a particular specific instance of God's rescue of Israel out of Egypt and through the Red Sea. When he says, where's your rage against the waters? He's recounting the Red Sea moment where Israel stood at the shore of the Red Sea, and all before them is water and death, and all behind them is Pharaoh's army and death. And what did he do there? He's remembering in this moment, he leveraged all of his infinite power to heap up the waters on one side and to heap up the waters on the other side. And he held those waters at bay, the giant storm, and water represents death in the Old Testament. He held death at bay while his people walked through on dry land. And then what did he do? He takes that power that he's rescuing his people by, and he brings it on the head of the enemy, on the serpent king Pharaoh. He crushes the enemy. He wields his power and grace for his glory and our good, and he uses it to aid his children. And if you remember in Exodus 14:14, when they're terrified of death before them and terrified of death behind them, it says in Exodus 14:14, the Lord will fight for you. You have only to be silent. Habakkuk 2:20, but the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. That's not simply a statement about his glory and grace. That is his greatness and grace, but it's also a statement to Habakkuk and to Judah. Trust me. I'm on my throne. You need only be silent while I work to rescue you. If God can lead his people out of an exodus in Egypt, he can do it again in Babylon. And if God can lead a people out of exodus, out of slavery in Egypt, and he can do it again in Babylon, then he can do it in your heart and mine. He can lead an exodus of people enslaved to sin. He can lead believers ensnared in sin out of slavery to sin and the serpent king. If he can do that then, and he can do that then, he can do that now. And it's an argument from the greater to the lesser. If he can lead an exodus to rescue his people out of slavery to sin, then he can handle whatever circumstance and situation you find yourself in. He is faithful and good and powerful. In Luke chapter 9, Jesus is remembering, or we remember in Luke chapter 9, Jesus and he goes up on a mountain with three disciples, Peter, James, and John, and he takes them with them. And in this moment, it's the Mount of Transfiguration, the moment where Jesus is transfigured, where his splendor and glory are shining forth in blinding light. And he's seen for who he really is. He's the Son of God, the Messiah, God in the flesh. And it says that he encounters there, they see Jesus and Moses and Elijah having a conversation. And in Luke chapter 9, verse 30, it says they were having a conversation about Jesus' departure. But if you notice, there's a little asterisk there. Because translators say that's a little fuzzy to say they're just talking about Jesus' departure. What it really means is they're talking about Jesus' exodus. Jesus' greater exodus, leading people out of the bondage to the serpent king into freedom. This is what is in Luke 9. So if Jesus, if God can do that out of Egypt and out of Babylon, and he can do that in our own hearts and in our own lives. And Habakkuk sees all of this, it leads him to worship, and it leads him finally to trust. And this is the last point here. In verse 16, after seeing the glory of God, the splendor of God, the greatness of God, and seeing how he wields that power on behalf of his people to rescue them, to seeing his grace, Habakkuk is terrified, rightly so, trembling before the holiness of God. He's also still terrified and trembling because the Babylonians are coming. But what's his confession? It leads him to hope. He sees the Babylonians, this great power coming, but he sees God's infinite power, infinite grace and grace, and he says, I therefore will wait. I will wait. Verse 16 tells us, I will quietly wait. And that word, we already looked at it earlier in chapter 2, but it needs to be said again, that word wait means to sit in peace, to sit in rest, to sit quietly. Though an army is approaching, though an army encamps against me, I will rest. How can someone possibly rest in the midst of enemies all around? In the midst of darkness and despair and crushing circumstances? How can someone rest in the midst of that? Habakkuk is resting in God. He is resting in his faithfulness. He's doing what he's already said, what God has called him to do in Habakkuk 2:4. He is resting in God's faithfulness. He's modeling for us Habakkuk 2:4. He's not trusting in himself. He's not trusting in his own intellect. He's not trusting in any horizontal solution. He's trusting in God and God alone in this moment. And therefore, it brings peace. It brings rest. It brings hope. He will rest and he lives by faith in God's faithfulness, his power, his character, his nature. And this is amazing. Especially if we remember where Habakkuk has been. When we started, we said that we started asking God, where are you? Can I trust you? He moved to God, I don't understand. I want to trust you. Then he moved to God, I'm scared. I will trust you. Now he's moving into God, I trust you. You're all I need. You're my only hope. There is no other source of salvation. There is no other help. There is no other rescue. There is no other hope. You are it. And my hope is in you. And how did he move from being the questioning prophet to the worshiping prophet? He says, I will quietly wait for the day of trouble. But it doesn't end with a period there. He's not simply waiting for calamity, looking forward to it, saying, well, I know it's coming. He is saying that in the text. He knows it's coming. Chapter 3, verse 2 says he recognizes it's coming. In the day of judgment, please be merciful. He knows judgment is coming. He knows that it's being poured out. But in this moment, he's longing for, waiting for the day of trouble to come upon people who invade us. He's trusting in God to act. He's trusting in God to invade and deal with the invaders. He's trusting God to invade into our suffering and circumstances to deal with suffering. Do you hear it? What Habakkuk is waiting for is not answered in his immediate prayer. But it is answered. Years later, 539 BC, Babylon is destroyed. Daniel chapter 5, verse 30 says that the king of Babylon dies. What Habakkuk longed for is provided for. God promised he would do it, and he does it. But what Habakkuk is ultimately longing for is answered in Jesus. Habakkuk is longing for God to enter into our suffering and deal with suffering once and for all. He's longing for God to enter into evil and to deal with evil once for all. He's longing for God to enter into death and put death to death. And what do we know in the New Testament? What is this pointing us to? This is a finger painting pointing us to Jesus. Because what do we know? God entered into our suffering to deal with our suffering. He entered in the flesh and blood. Entered in flesh and blood in Jesus. More than we need out of our circumstances or our circumstances removed from us, we need God to invade our circumstances. And he has. And he did. He did it in Jesus. And what's amazing here in the text, again, the finger painting that's showing us, this is pointing us ultimately to Jesus. What he longs for is solved in Jesus. He says what he's worshiping, what he's celebrating in verse 13. You went out for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. That's referring in context to Israel and Moses, who's called the Lord's anointed or prophet of God. You went out for the salvation of your people. You went out for the salvation of your anointed. You crushed the head of the house of the wicked, laying him bare from thigh to neck. And how did he do it? Verse 14 says, you took the weapon of the enemy and used it on him. Habakkuk is remembering the storyline of the Bible. Because in Genesis chapter 3, after man rebels, lifts his fists, we're alienated from God, alienated within, alienated without. The world is broken and fractured and fragmented. God was still gracious and provided for us a promise of a redeemer. Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, that a son would come, and that son would be bruised, but he would bruise the head of the serpent. Bruise and bruise, same word in the English translation, but has two different meanings. That son would be wounded, but through his wounding, he would crush the head of the enemy. Crush the serpent. Fast forward to Exodus, and how does it begin? In Exodus chapter 1, the people of Israel are being oppressed, and their firstborn sons are being killed. And then how does God rescue them? On the night of the Passover, an angel of the Lord appears to Moses, teaches Moses. God speaks to Moses, says, cover the doorpost with blood. I am calling for the life of the firstborn. Firstborn sons will die tonight unless they're covered by the substitutionary blood of the Lamb. That night, all of Israel covers their doorposts and they're spared. But Pharaoh's firstborn son dies. What he meant for evil, God meant for good. Leveraged on top of his head, took his own weapon and used it against him. Fast forward to 1 Samuel 17 and the story of David and Goliath, and you know the story, but I challenge you to go back and read 1 Samuel chapter 17 and pay attention to what you're reading. Because the text, the writer goes out of his way to emphasize that David did not have a sword in his hand when he went to Goliath. On one hand is Goliath and the Philistines, and they're chanting, and remember his taunt? Send your champion out. Send your champion. And if he can defeat me, we will become your servants. We will bow before you. But if we beat you, you will bow before us. And what happens? David marches out. It says in the text, he took his shepherd's staff, his sling, and five smooth stones. But it says that there was no sword in his hand. But what does David say when he approaches Goliath? He's got a shepherd's staff, a sling, and five stones, and he says, this day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. He doesn't have a sword. And what does the text emphasize? He slings the stone, it sinks in his head, he falls down flat. David picks up the sword of Goliath, his own weapon, and off with his head. He crushes the head of the great giant with his own weapon. Fast forward to what Habakkuk is saying. He's saying the same thing, what he has remembered, but what God is going to do, what he did in Jesus. He invaded our darkness to crush the head of the house of the wicked by being crushed on our behalf. He was laid bare. Jesus was laid bare, exposed from thigh to neck, so that you and I could be covered. He was forsaken so that you and I could be brought in. He was pierced so that we would not have to be, but so the enemy would be crushed and destroyed. Is that your hope? If he can do that, then he can aid, he can rescue, he can provide in whatever circumstances you find yourself in. Can you say your faith, your salvation is in God's faithfulness alone? In your suffering, will you remember the gospel? Will you stake your flag in the ground in the gospel? Though I don't feel like I'm loved in these circumstances, though I wonder if God is still on the throne, I will stake my flag in the ground. I know he's on the throne. I know that he's faithful. I know that he's powerful. And I know that he loves me. And the cross is the greatest testimony of that. I will look to the cross and I will cling to it. Maybe you want to. Maybe that's what you long to do, but you don't feel like it right now. Here's what we know the answer is not. The answer is not to follow your feelings away from God. The answer is to run to Him so that what might be a longing in your heart, what might be just a whisper on your lips, becomes a song from the rooftops. The answer is only by clinging to God, only by running to His faithfulness. And the greatest testimony of His faithfulness to you is His faithfulness in Jesus. It's clinging to Jesus' faithfulness on your behalf, even when you don't feel like it. And what we see and what we learn is as we cling in the midst of the pain, though our circumstances preach a different message, though our feelings preach a different message, though our minds preach a different message, though sometimes our friends preach a different message, no, the only answer, the only hope is clinging to Jesus and Jesus alone. And that's the key. That's the turn. That's where we turn from lament to trust, from questioning to worship. This is the trajectory of Psalm 77, Psalm 17, Psalm 25. This is the trajectory of Habakkuk. This is the trajectory of the Bible from darkness to light. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we give You all reverence and honor and glory for Your power and splendor that You have revealed in Your Word. Lord, sometimes we just don't see it and we question You. Thank You for being a gracious God and not crushing us. That's one of the greatest testimonies of the book of Habakkuk. You don't crush this prophet for asking questions. You cling all the more. You respond. You reveal. And you remind. You remind with grace of Your past faithfulness, past power. Lord, for the person in this room that has not yet clung to Jesus as their only hope, may they. For the rest who have clung to Jesus, Lord, we walk ebb and flow through life and seasons where we forget Your past faithfulness. Please bring it ever to our minds. Revive it now in the midst of our days. Remind us now. May we sing the song of Habakkuk. And for those who it's only a whisper, remind of Your great faith, faithfulness, great power, and that You are with and for. And if You are with us and You are for us with that kind of power, that kind of faithfulness, what do we have to fear? May we all be able to sing this song from the rooftops, and may the world take notice. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.